This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 159 was recorded on March 21st, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Gluskin Sheff Chief Economist David Rosenberg joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss everything from the Fed to the stock market to bond yields and get an update on whether David still thinks that the top is in for this market cycle. Be sure to stay tuned for extended equity market coverage and our post-game segment. Patrick has prepared another of his famous chart books and will be discussing what we believe is a coming market top and how to trade it.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, before we even get into the equities, let's quickly cover Wednesday's FOMC statement. I mean, what's your take on the announcement?
Well, Patrick, let's put this in context, because I think that's been missing, frankly, in the way the market has reacted to the Fed. The FOMC has effectively admitted that the economy is not strong enough and inflation has not developed sufficiently to allow them to continue their coveted hiking cycle beyond one more hike. And there's plenty of room to speculate that there won't be any more hikes, that, that's it already. So the Fed thinks the U.S. economy isn't as good as previously believed and cannot tolerate further hiking. On the back of this, the stock market rockets higher in celebration of more accommodation from the Fed. To my thinking, Patrick, this bad news is good news mentality perfectly defines my argument for why this bull market has been entirely about central bank accommodation and why the market cannot tolerate a follow through on quantitative tightening. Now, the operative word there is follow through. The promises of quantitative tightening, and then it never really comes to fruition and it only happens temporarily and then they shut it back down. Obviously, we can tolerate that, but I don't believe that the market can tolerate an actual normalization of the Fed balance sheet back to where it was before they started all this quantitative easing. So for now, the bulls are celebrating the end of hikes. And as much as it doesn't make sense to me, the last 10 years should have taught us that this is going to send stock prices higher.
Okay, well, let's get right to it with the S&P 500.
Seems to me like the next key level is 2877. That was the high before the VIX fiasco last year. So as we're approaching the close here on Thursday afternoon, I'm just looking at my chart. We're at, 2862? So we're 15 points away from that 2877, which seems to me like the right shoulder in a head and shoulders pattern, a logical top. Does that mean that's going to be the top? I'm torn. I really think that we've got confirmation from the Fed that the economic cycle is ending. It's time for a bear market. It's time for a recession. But frankly, every time the Fed announces that they're going to be accommodative, it usually sends markets higher than I'm capable of imagining that they were able to go. Is this going to push us to new all-time highs? Certainly, it's not out of the question at this point. If we do break out to new all-time highs, that's going to be self-reinforcing because at this point, technical traders are going to see that breakout as a bullish sign. They're going to buy it and it's going to move even higher. I definitely think this is crazy. I've said before I would be astonished if we get to new all-time highs. I'm sticking by my call. I will be astonished. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen. Charlie McElligott in his letter today said he still sees those risks that he's written so much about for the next 3 to 4 weeks. But even Charlie acknowledges that there's probably more upside likely after those downside risks come out of scope in the next 3 or 4 weeks. We get out of the corporate buyback blackout and so forth. There's lots of reason for people to continue to bid this market higher. It doesn't make any logical sense to me on a rational basis, but if there's anything the last 10 years have taught us, when the Fed goes super accommodative, stocks go up, whether it makes sense or not.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar.
If ever there was a Fed announcement that was going to break the back of the dollar rally, this should have been the one. You couldn't get much bigger of a dovish surprise than we got. But look what happened. There was a panic knee-jerk lower, exactly as you would expect. Right now on Thursday afternoon, Patrick, we're not only trading above 96, just barely a couple of basis points above 96, but we're fully above the entire daily range from 2 days ago, the day before the Fed announcement. So if this didn't do it, and, you know, we did sort of break the pattern, but, you know, I wasn't going to be surprised if I saw a 93 handle on the dollar index this morning. We had a knee-jerk reaction lower that wasn't that much lower. It basically matched the prior low from a few weeks ago, and now we're already recovering from it. To me, this is just really, really strong confirmation that the dollar rally is intact. If it can survive this Fed action, this surprise from the Fed, it can survive anything. And I think that's what we're seeing here, is that the dollar squeeze argument that Jeff Snyder has made so eloquently is what's playing out here. And I expect that we're about to move higher.
Well, how about crude oil at 60? What's your thinking here?
Well, Patrick, as our listeners know, I've been saying that I expected the market to top soon. I didn't think it was going to go over 60. As someone famous once said, when the facts change, I change my opinion. And the facts have changed, and changed a lot. We were expecting a build on inventory because seasonally that's what's to be expected during refinery maintenance, which is what's going on right now. Instead, we got a drawdown, and it wasn't just a little drawdown, 9.6 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 468,000 barrels. That now is starting to look like a trend. Three or four Cushing draws in a row. I just saw the Genscape data today, the private data, expecting another really big drawdown in Cushing, maybe upwards of a million barrels coming next week. We'll see how that develops. Gasoline, another 4.6 million barrels. That's on the back of a drawdown last week of 4.6 million barrels. Distillates, another 4.1 million barrels. So we've got massive, massive drawdowns across the board on both crude and finished products happening at a time of year when we seasonally expect builds on inventory. This is restocking season. This is utterly, massively bullish inventory surprise news, and it was completely unexpected by analysts. Now, I do still see signs, Patrick, of upside exhaustion in this market. And the reason I say that is, okay, this is the kind of move that you wouldn't be surprised to see the price go up $3 in a single day in reaction to a 10 million barrel draw on inventory during refinery maintenance season. Holy cow, that's just totally unexpected. We got a $1 pop, and it started trading off until the Fed statement helped it to eventually move higher again. And even as I look this afternoon, we're starting to sell off again a little bit. So, you know, considering how incredibly bullish this surprise inventory news was, the fact that it was only good for about a dollar worth of upside says to me that this market is tired. So what it does is it puts my bearish view on hold. If next week we get a resumption of seasonally normal inventory reports, in other words, we start seeing builds on inventory, hey, I think at that point the market's toast. We're going straight down if that happens. But especially from the Genscape data that I just saw this afternoon, looks like we could be headed toward another drawdown on inventory next week. There's no way prices are going down if we keep seeing 10 million barrel draws on inventory. So too many people are confused. How is it possible? How is it even plausible that this could be happening during turnaround season when the refineries are going through maintenance to switch over from the winter grades to the summer grades of gasoline, and that reduces their crude oil consumption? We normally expect builds on inventory. Give you the word in one answer: exports. It didn't used to be legal to export U.S. crude, and I think we're going through a fundamental paradigm shift where people have seasonal expectations that you always build inventory this time of year because the refineries are using less. Well, they might be using less, but the oil they're not using is getting shipped overseas. Now, is it going into storage in China, or is it actually being consumed? We don't know that, and it's no longer visible through the U.S. reporting system. So it's a cloudy picture, and exactly what it means is a little bit unclear. For now, though, we got to watch and see what the next few weeks of inventory bring. I certainly am ready to put my short position back on against WTI crude, but I'm not going to do that if we're going to see a bunch of more bullish inventory reports, and it looks like this might not be over yet.
Let's move on to gold here. What's the next move here for bullion?
Well, obviously, this massively dovish FOMC surprise should have been bullish for gold, which it was. Gold went shooting up yesterday on the day of the news. What happened today? It retraced most of that. And it says to me gold is not ready for the big upside breakout that everybody seems to want and be expecting. I'm going to stay on the sidelines for now. Now, without a doubt, gold will be the asset to own when it becomes clear to everyone that the Fed has backed itself into a corner with no way out. I just don't think we're there yet. And I think there's room, especially look how strong and resilient the dollar has been in the face of this very dovish pivot from the Fed. I think it says that even despite the dovishness of the Fed, there's room for gold prices to continue to drift lower. And that doesn't mean that has to happen, but I won't be persuaded until I see a clear breakout above 1350 at this point. Meanwhile, I'm hoping for lower prices so that hopefully I can get a chance to buy a large position in gold at a much more attractive price. We'll see what happens.
Well, let's move on to treasury yields because, wow, I mean, we shot down to the 2.5 and hit it right in the wake of the Fed announcement. What comes next here?
Well, clearly, we're below that 2.60 yield that I've emphasized for several weeks was important to watch, and we didn't just barely tick below it. We clearly took out that number. So far, so good for my bullish price, bearish yield outlook. I do think, and certainly you'll hear David Rosenberg comment on this as well, I think there's plenty of room for bond yields to move lower here as the economy weakens. But the challenge is going to be, can we stay below that 2.60 yield and move lower? I want to quote Richard Koo, and I'm actually copying this from Charlie McElligott's Daily Letter today. He quotes Richard Koo describing the quantitative easing trap. He says as follows, "The QE trap happens when the central bank has purchased long-term government bonds as part of quantitative easing. Initially, long-term interest rates fall much more than they would in a country without such a policy, which means the subsequent economic recovery comes sooner. But as the economy picks up, long-term rates rise sharply as local bond market participants fear the central bank will have to mop up all the excess reserves by unloading its holding of long-term bonds. Demand then falls, interest rate-sensitive sectors such as automobiles and housing, causing the economy to slow, forcing central banks to relax their policy stance. The economy heads toward recovery again, but as market participants refocus on the possibility of the central bank absorbing excess reserves, long-term rates surge in a repetitive cycle I've dubbed the QE trap." So, Patrick, the scenario that Richard Koo is describing, and I think the reason Charlie McElligott is quoting it in today's letter, is we do have this potential knock-on effect of quantitative easing where we may be facing spikes of higher yields. Now, those would be driven by economic recovery. If anything, the Fed seems to be acknowledging that the economy is weak, but of course, everybody is jumping for joy and celebration. So it really remains to be seen. Can we stay below 2.60, or are some of these QE spikes that Richard Koo describes going to maybe take us back up in yields as the market anticipates the difficulty that the Fed is eventually going to have in unwinding all of this accommodation? So we'll see what happens. But for now, I think that we're probably going to continue to see a trend lower in yields. Will we take out the previous low from 2016? I don't know, but I'm definitely going to be asking David Rosenberg because I'm very fascinated to get his perspective on that.
So this week's featured interview guest is David Rosenberg. So Eric, why did we invite David back as our featured interview guest this week?
Well, David has been really an iconic figure in the industry for decades, going back to his Merrill Lynch days. The Breakfast with Dave newsletter, I'm not sure exactly whether this is true, but it feels to me like it is probably the most widely read paid newsletter in existence. I mean, it's everybody knows about it. The last time that we had Dave on the program, he told us that he thought the top was in for this market. It'll be interesting to see whether he still thinks that in the wake of the FOMC announcement.
Eric's interview with David is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Gluskin Sheff, Chief Economist and Strategist David Rosenberg. David, it's great to have you back on the program. Obviously, the big news in the last couple of days is the Fed's dovish reversal. And the thing that's just fascinating to me is the way I see this is the Fed has basically admitted that the economy is not strong enough to continue their hiking cycle, and inflation has not surfaced the way that they hoped it would. And based on this, the fact that they're admitting that the economy is weak, everybody's celebrating and just can't buy enough stocks. Am I missing something? And what do you make of the Fed's policy change in the last couple of days?
Well, I actually started to see this coming in the last few months of 2018, when I could see some of the strains emerging in the global economy, and the U.S. does not live on an island. And you know, you could see this in other central banks, Bank of Canada, Reserve Bank of Australia, the Bank of England. I mean, just look at what Mark Carney's been saying, and not just about Brexit uncertainty, but globally in general. And I was waiting, actually, for the Fed to start talking about some of these constraints, because they seem to have been like an ostrich with the head in the sand. I was amazed that in that market maelstrom in December that they actually would have raised interest rates. It was historic for the Fed to raise rates in a sort of market meltdown across the spectrum that we saw. The bottom line is that, you know, you had mentioned about the inflation side. It's interesting that in the question answer period, Powell did talk about the frustration of getting inflation to its goal of 2%, although from my lens, we're pretty well almost there. To me, it was the commentary on the economy. I think that's much bigger shift than just on the inflation side. It's tough to talk about how terribly low inflation is, looking at the commodity complex, and oil prices aren't at $40 anymore, they're at $60. To me, it was, you know, the commentary on the labor market, the commentary especially on the consumer and business sector, talking about how these key components of domestic demand are now embarking on, in quotes, slower growth. You know, you go back to the January 30th statement, and the Fed was talking about, again, in quotes, household spending has continued to grow strongly. I think that's been the biggest shift, is a view on the consumer. And I think that the big bull call from those that have a positive bent on the economy was that the first quarter, you know, over and beyond the government shutdown and the polar vortex, was that we were going to get great consumer spending in the first quarter based on those bloated tax refunds. And yet the part of the statement that got downgraded the most was on the consumer part. And to me, that really is, alongside very weak capital spending, the big question marks on the economy. So to me, what was really, I think, important for the markets and why the stock market initially had trouble digesting it, be closed down on the day, was everybody wanted the Fed to be dovish, but maybe they were a little too dovish. And some people in the marketplace now are wondering, you know, what is it about the economy that the Fed knows that we don't know? Or maybe what is it about the bond market? Because the really big move has been in treasuries. And so the treasury market's telling you something about the economy that I don't think is fully priced into the stock market even today.
Definitely want to come back to the bond market, but let's start with the stock market. Last time we had you on the show last year in 2018, after the whole VIX fiasco had occurred, we were in the bounce off of that. I asked you if the top was in. You said probably maybe one more push to a new high, which is what we got. You said it wouldn't last. Sure enough, it didn't last. And then, of course, we had the Christmas massacre. I thought really the top was in. But boy, we're almost back to all-time highs. Do you think that the top is in, or you think we're headed for one more crazy push higher before reality sets in on this market?
Well, you know, I think that from a big picture standpoint, and all you really have to do is look at the chart, and you don't have to be a technical genius to see a real classic head and shoulders pattern emerging in the S&P 500. Look, we're in a topping process. You know, we hit a peak in January 26th of last year. Then we retested, got marginally above on much poorer breadth than market internals on September the 20th. And you're right, now making another run. Countless times in the past year, we've made this move up or through 2800. Doesn't seem to last. I think the markets are telling you that you want to take chips off the table, or if you don't want to take chips off the table, maybe start selling some call options on your holdings and play the range. You could argue the 2400 back on Christmas Eve was a flash crash, sort of a low. But the chart's telling you that we're in a range of 2600 to 2800. I have a tough time justifying any sort of blow off to new all-time highs. I imagine it's quite possible based on my outlook for earnings. We are going into an earnings recession. I don't think it's going to be a one-quarter wonder. But I think that what's happened is the market has laid down its cards. It's told you what it believes. The market believes, as the consensus believes, that the soft patch in the economy in the first quarter was a temporary phenomenon, that we're going to have a resurgence in growth in the back half of the year. And the stock market's reflecting that this will prove to be a flash in the pan, and that earnings momentum is going to gather steam in the last two or three quarters of the year, and that's what they're pricing in. I think there'll be room for profound disappointment on that score. I think that the fiscal stimulus last year bought us an extra year of growth. Of course, at the same time, it pushed the Fed into the uncomfortable position of having to raise interest rates more than it otherwise would have. But I think this is going to be a very challenging year for growth, not just in the U.S., but globally. And earnings expectations will continue to come down, and you have to have a very solid reason to believe why PE multiples will continue to expand. I mean, this has already been a 3-point multiple expansion just in the past 3 months. That doesn't happen very often. And now you're back pressing a 16 forward PE on the S&P 500, which you can argue isn't bubble territory, but it is a market that definitely is fully valued. But my money is on the Treasury market. You can't have it both ways. The 10-year note yield is already down to almost 2.5%. You've got every part of the curve out to the 7-year maturity below the top end of the Fed funds range. So really, we're talking about a flat to an inverted yield curve. The bond market is telling you the shape of the curve, whether you believe it's fully inverted or just plain flat, the yield curve is telling you that we are into a period of soft economic growth that is going to transcend the first quarter. If the bond market believed this is a one-quarter wonder, we'd have the 10-year note closer to 2.75 or 3 than 2.5. The bond market usually has the story right, and I think we have to respect that. And back to your earlier question, is that is this about, you know, that inflation is uncomfortably low? You know, inflation is low. I don't know why the Fed's fretting about inflation. Like I said, oil's not 30 or 40. It's 60. But inflation with or without oil is still fairly low. To me, it's more just about what the economy is doing. And the bond market's giving you a very consistent story, and not just the shape of the yield curve, but take a look at the segment that is dragging nominal yields lower, and it's the real rate. This has actually not really been an inflation expectation story. The real rate in the 10-year, looking at the TIPS market, has collapsed over the past couple of months. And the real rate is consistent with a view on real growth. So to me, we will continue to see the economy come in below expectations. And I think that the market's telling the Fed right now, certainly the bond market, it is behind the curve, but it's not the first time we've seen the Fed play catch up to the market. And I expect we'll see more of that as the year unfolds.
Do you think there's room to see new lows? It was what, one spot 32 or something, which Jeff Gundlach famously stood up and said, okay, that's it. You know, the bottom is in for bond yields. Do you think there's room to even print a new low if we get into a recession, or how far can this go?
Well, if you go back to the July 31st, August 1st set of FOMC minutes, it starts off very unusually, by the way, with a Fed economic staff presentation to the FOMC. And it's all about how to fight the next recession. It's about the effect of lower bound on interest rates if the economy hits another rough patch. And they come right out and say that in the event of another recession, and unless you believe the business cycle has been totally repealed, and there are some people that actually believe that, they come out right out and say that we're taking rates back down to zero. Now, look, you're already starting to see the Fed pause. They took out two rate hikes they were going to do this year. Now they're at zero. They're going to be ending their quantitative tightening by September and tapering that quantitative tightening starting in May. So the ball is already rolling in that direction. You know, the Fed is an incremental animal. And by the time they start cutting rates, the stock market will be begging for it. And the bond market, of course, right now is starting to price that in as of the Fed futures contracts. But what's key here is the Fed has come out and told you that they're going to cut rates back down to zero. They're going to re-embark on QE. You know, whether or not we end up seeing the modern monetary theory come to the fore, who knows? That would be a more aggressive form of non-conventional easing that we had under quantitative easing. But we probably will end up with some sort of debt monetization. But those set of FOMC minutes, and I recommend that everybody goes to the Fed website and read the July 31st, August 1st set of minutes, because they tell you about the roadmap of the future. And I believe that a recession is coming. I might be early. It's not the first time I would have been early on a recession call, but it's out there. And you don't even have to get the timing right. If you have a view that in the next 12, 24 months, the business cycle will take its course, we will have a recession, then just know that the Fed is going back to the old playbook, and they're going to cut the funds rate to zero. If they got the funds rate to zero, the entire yield curve is going to melt. So I don't know if we go back and test 1.3 in the 10-year note, we could. But if we go back to a zero funds rate, then to me, it is not a difficult forecast to make that the 10-year will at least get to 1.5 and the long bond will at least get to 2. And if you're really looking about how to invest in that environment, and maybe I'm really jumping ahead here, but you want to own in the stock market, if you have to be fully invested, I certainly want to be in non-cyclical parts of the stock market that have reliable dividend growth and dividend yield characteristics. I want income equity, and I also want long-term high-quality bonds. And in fact, if my forecast is right, the total return in long-dated 30-year zero-coupon bonds in the next 24 months will be close to a 40% net return. So you can actually get that sort of return and not have to take on equity-like risk in the bond market by being maximum duration. And so I think that's out there. So do I think that we will actually break to new lows in yields? You don't have to make that forecast. Do I think we will challenge those lows of 2016? I absolutely think that is in our future. It's a matter as to whether it's going to be this year's story or next year's story, but it's out there.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Fed's ability to fight back against the next downturn, and particularly with respect to MMT, because I agree with you. The Fed's going to take the funds rate to zero. That's kind of their first play. What I kind of see on the horizon is I think that if they try to propose another round of QE that looks like the last several, I think the political left is going to say, no way. There's going to be a huge revolt, and people are going to say, look, if you're going to create money out of thin air, it needs to be helicopter money. Give it to the people, not to Wall Street. And it seems to me, I certainly understand their point. I understand why people are frustrated with those bailouts, but that's a whole different animal. QE that is to fund helicopter money is a completely different equation than the last few cycles. So number one, do you think I'm right to believe that that's a possibility, that it would become politically impractical to have another round of QE that looks like the last three rounds? And if so, what would that mean in terms of markets?
Right. Well, no, I think actually you're 100% on the money with that observation. You know, QE1 addressed a market failure in mortgages that I think even the most ardent libertarian would have supported, you know, back in 2009. The ensuing quantitative easings and incursions by the Bernanke Fed was all aimed at promoting a stronger stock market. And actually, what was incredible was then the day after QE2, which nobody really saw coming, the day after, Ben Bernanke actually had an editorial of his printed in the Washington Post, pretty well telling everybody we are doing this to generate a positive equity wealth effect on spending. And well, we didn't get a whole lot of spending, but we got a lot of equity market wealth. And of course, it just provided added distortions, because not only do we have record income inequality, but this created a situation of also record wealth inequality, with no evident impacts that it had any significant multiplier impacts on overall economic growth, although I'm sure the proponents, including Mr. Bernanke himself, would probably suggest otherwise. But the proof of the pudding is in the eating. We had record monetary stimulus, and we still had the weakest economic expansion of all time, and that includes two rounds of huge fiscal stimulus as well between Obama and Trump. But you know, to your point, I think you're 100% right. We are in the laws of diminishing returns when it comes to policy stimulus. And a couple of things that are worth observing. The first is that historically, when you go into a recession, and this is on average and with a very tight standard deviation, the Fed historically, to fight a recession, cuts the funds rate 500 basis points. Well, they're peaking out at 2.5. There's no 500 basis points this time for the Fed to play with. At least the last cycle, the funds rate peaked at 5.25. The Fed went to zero. This time around, the starting point is going to be 2.5. Historically, you got to cut their funds rate by 5 percentage points. And what happened in the last cycle that is going to serve at least as some sort of template is that when the Fed realized the extent of the deflationary detonation that was happening in the credit markets and in the housing market, that they had to cut the funds rate by 700 basis points, not 500. And so that's literally what they did with QE, was to create a synthetically negative interest rate. Now, when push came to shove, and you look at what's called the shadow Fed funds rate, and you can see this on the St. Louis Fed website, de facto, with the balance sheet effect, the funds rate actually went to minus 5% this cycle. I mean, people don't realize how aggressive the Fed got. They ultimately cut the funds rate, when you include the expansion of the balance sheet, by 1,000 basis points, 10 percentage points. They went much further than you could ever have imagined. And so that's what they did with quantitative easing. The central banks overseas, you know, when you take a look at some of the Scandinavian countries and the ECB, you know, they went negative on rates. The Fed didn't go outright negative, but created that synthetic condition with quantitative easing. You know, what will they do in the next go around? I agree that, you know, what can they possibly add to their balance sheet is not going to have a big impact. So I do believe that, you know, whether it's called modern monetary theory or whether it's just called outright debt monetization, I do see that happening. In fact, what's interesting is that everything the Fed did, every single acronym that the Fed did, from TAF to TALF to QE, was all in the famous speech that Bernanke gave, the famous what-if speech in November of 2002, which actually got Bernanke the moniker of Helicopter Ben. And so the concept of helicopter money, which is nothing new, but was introduced from a central bank standpoint when Bernanke was governor. He outlined a whole menu of options of what the Fed would do to fight a deflationary recession with interest rates at zero. I don't think he realized it was going to happen. It certainly didn't happen in 2002, 2003, but it did happen 6 years later. And he did everything in that playbook except debt monetization, which is the big bazooka. That he did not do, but I would, if you're going to ask me in the next cycle, the next downturn, what will the Fed do to finally terminate this malaise once and for all, insofar as, you know, do we use fiscal policy alongside that? Will be outright debt monetization, which is a completely different animal than creating excess bank reserves in the system, which is what QE was all about. But if you can ask me, will we see outright debt monetization, helicopter money, in the next couple of years? I firmly expect it.
Dave, I want to go a little bit deeper on this subject of modern monetary theory. I personally am skeptical of it, but you know, something I've figured out is it's coming. The rate at which the modern monetary camp or modern monetary theory camp is gaining political momentum. And I've been surprised by how many notable people in finance have really come out very much in favor of it, which has definitely surprised me. It seems to me like we're going to at least experiment with this this idea that supposedly if you don't have an inflationary backdrop, which we certainly don't right now, hey, it's just fine to have the biggest deficits you want, spend, universal basic income, social spending, and so forth. Let's help some people out in society, and I'm certainly all for helping people out. But the theory is don't worry about paying for it. It's not a big deal. Do you agree? Is there some real promise if the modern monetary theory crowd discovered something that's been eluding us for a long time? And if not, what could go wrong here?
Well, you know, once again, it's got a nice little acronym, MMT. It's not really that new. I was saying before, you know, I said two things that people should have some homework here is said to read the FOMC minutes from that July 31st, August 1st meeting to see that the Fed knows there's a recession out there and that they're going to react aggressively. And the first thing they'll do is cut rates to zero. So I mentioned that. And I mentioned the famous Bernanke speech from November 2002, the helicopter speech. I think we have to go back and reread that. It's just a, you know, so we'll call it modern monetary theory. It's just debt monetization. You've had also a whole bunch of academics come out against it, but it's right there. In fact, Bernanke talked about it not just in November of 2002, but in a follow-up speech he gave in the spring of 2003 to the Bank of Japan about how to get out of their long-term economic malaise. And his whole premise was the marriage of monetary policy and fiscal policy. And he actually called it a monetary-financed tax cut. That's right out of the Bernanke playbook. So, you know, this isn't really anything new. It is actually just an extension of the increasing aggressiveness that the Fed has had to be over the course of the past two decades, because the nature of these recessions are completely different. Society has morphed into asset-based cycles as opposed to inventory-based cycles. And I want to come back to that in a second, if I may. But the point here is that what happens with debt monetization, or however you want to call it, or helicopter money, is the Treasury puts, call it a perpetual, could be a $5 trillion coin, a 100-year bond, on the balance sheet of the Fed, and the Fed prints that money and then hands it over to the Treasury to do with it what you would like. And you know, you don't have to change the tax system. You don't have to change any laws and have it held up in the House or the Senate. And there's a whole bunch of things you could do with that money to try and stimulate aggregate demand. And then we'll create a whole new inflationary experience, and then we'll be worried at some point about inflation, and we'll deal with it then. But this is the last page of the Bernanke playbook. And if you buy the premise that you've already done 90%, in the past number of years of what Bernanke was already talking about, you know, at this point, 17 years ago, I think that that's where we're going to be heading. But it's nothing new. It is aggressive. You know, but you can argue quantitative easing was aggressive too. Did QE work? It's hard to say. In a counterfactual, it didn't exactly produce an inflationary economic boom, but some people will say, well, things would have been much worse without it. The European Central Bank, take a look, went to negative interest rates, as did some of the Scandinavian countries. Don't see that that's done a whole lot of good for their banking system, and their economy is still stuck in the mud. So, yeah, we're basically going to, in the next downturn, have to get, you can call it creative, experimental, but the Fed is going to get a lot more aggressive. So the answer is yes. If it's not MMT or it's not debt monetization, I guess I'll call that DM so I can get an acronym in, the Fed is going to get extremely aggressive. And that's what I was saying before. Go back to the past two decades, really since the onset of the Greenspan era. You know, we go into the late 1980s after the Fed helps create the commercial real estate bubble, and we have that recession in the early 90s. The funds rate goes from 9 7/8 down to 3. And then it takes about 3 years to get a recovery. But 9 7/8, then down to 3. And then in the dot-com cycle, of course, the Fed stayed too loose for too long. We had the dot-com bubble, the tech wreck, and the Fed takes the funds rate from 6.5% down to 1. And then, of course, they stay too easy for too long. Always easy to say in hindsight, but they take the funds rate to 5.25% back in 2006, 2007, and then all the way down to 0 with QE, which brought it down to -5%. as the shadow funds rate. So let's get this straight. In the last number of cycles, 9 7/8 down to 3. 6.5% down to 1. 5.25% down to 0. And now we're 2.5. And they're going to probably have to cut rates at least 500 basis points and create a new synthetic negative funds rate, unless they actually want to go that route and actually take rates negative. And by the way, if you read some of the Fed research that's out there right now, there are people talking about, will we go into outright negative interest rates? And negative interest rates are supposed to hurt you so badly by having your money in the bank because you're losing money, you're going to go on to spend the money. And that's how you create inflation. Well, it hasn't worked so well in Europe, as we've seen so far. But just think about how increasingly aggressive the Fed has been over the past two decades. And now the starting point of the funds rate is 2.5%. So, of course, the Fed in the next downturn is going to have to get extremely aggressive and extremely creative. So some form of debt monetization, I think it's out there. And again, I think that at some point, maybe it's too early to do it now, but how do you want to invest in that environment? Well, you want to have hard assets. I imagine commodities will do well. I imagine gold, precious metals will do well. And I think in your bond portfolio, you want to, you know, have a stash of TEPs on hand as well. Because the one thing that will come out of it, if it's successful, is that we will get at least a moderate return to inflation with that sort of stimulus.
One final question on fixed income markets. You know, we talked about the reasons why bond yields, treasury yields, should continue to move lower. And I completely agree. I understand the logic. I'm with you on that safe debt. But what's happening is as those bond yields are moving lower, the junk-rated fixed income is moving in sympathy with it. We're not seeing much of a widening in those spreads. And, you know, at one point, I think we actually had some European junk rated bonds that were yielding lower than U.S. treasuries. So it seems to me like there's just a massive risk. And also, as you know, there's so many bonds that are just one tick above junk. And if they were downgraded, they would have to be sold and it could start a vicious cycle. It seems to me that the lowest quality, or maybe even the triple B's, one step above junk, are where there's just a huge amount of risk in the bond market. Am I wrong to think that? And how does it play in with your overall view of lowering yields on the treasuries and you know, investment grade credits?
Right. Well, a couple of things to address there. It's tough to compare, you know, European credit when the ECB, I mean the Fed has not been buying corporate bonds. But the ECB has, and so their corporate bond market is really completely distorted by the long arm of the ECB. In terms of the comment about spreads, firstly, in the high yield market, almost 20% of that market now has got energy-related names. And when you're going to take oil up 30% from the lows to $60, high yield is going to get a bid because one of the strongest correlations now is with the price of oil. Because so many of those companies got pushed into non-investment grade when oil took that big hit in 2015, 2016. But spreads in general are very tight, and that's just reflecting what the stock market's been doing in this sharp bounce back off the lows. So this has been just positive risk appetite related to, in a large part, to the Fed will save us. There's no more rate risk from the Fed. You've got a situation where the PBOC has eased policy, hopes that their fiscal reflation, which has been quite modest, is going to help underpin growth there. There's also expectations, of course, that we're going to have a smooth Brexit transition, which I'm not so sure about that anymore, and that, you know, we'll have a successful resolution on the trade side, which I think that, again, that's up for debate. But you see, the markets in general are just making some huge assumptions right now that growth is going to be revived after the first quarter. Everything that's negative is temporary. Everything that's positive is permanent. And so you have a lot of good news. If you told me that we're going to have a 3 multiple point expansion in the SPX in the past 3 months, I would tell you, against that backdrop, credit spreads are going to tighten in dramatically because it's all part of the same story, which is risk on. But we know from the experience last year, and I certainly know from experience being in the business 35 years, that nothing is permanent. And I certainly don't think that this rally in equities or the tightening that we've seen in spreads is going to be a long-lasting development. I'm very skeptical on that front. Your point about, the triple Bs, and I've been writing about it, you know, we've never had a situation where we have 50% of the investment grade market, $3 trillion of corporate bonds rated triple B, and one notch away from being downgraded to junk, which is a very big deal. Nothing nefarious has happened yet. The credit agencies basically only have 5% of this debt in the triple B space on credit watch with negative implications, even though 30% of this debt right now has a, these companies in the triple B space have a debt to EBITDA ratio in line with the junk bond market. So some people will say, well, you know, there go the rating agencies again, you know, backstopping the issuers at the expense of the investors, but I'm not so sure that's the case. I think that what's interesting is that companies are going to the rating agencies in this triple B space and showing them what their spending plans are going to be for the coming year. And if you're taking a look at any survey out there, and today, of course, we got the Business Roundtable, the CEO survey. We got the Philly Fed survey today for March. Capital spending plans are faltering. This is something, again, that the Fed talked about yesterday about capital spending slowing down. This has not been a key feature of the Fed's forecast until very recently. And so there's going to be a lot of competition for cash flows this year, for slowing cash flows, tight labor markets, so wages will be one. Rolling over debt into a higher rate environment from where the debt was originated is a second. And so companies are going to have to make room or else they will default. And how will they make the room? They'll make the room by cutting their hiring plans, which again, you're starting to see in the data, and in capital spending plans. So there's no get out of jail free card here. If we do not go through a fallen angel cycle or a default cycle, there's a reason for it. And the reason is because companies are cutting back on their spending plans. And we're seeing that already. So we may not see actually a big default or downgrading cycle as companies stave that off by diverting their cash flows away from stock buybacks and away from capital spending towards debt retirement and debt service. So this is the year of the debt diet, just as you would go back to the period in 2008, 2009, when it was an era of debt deleveraging in the household sector. I think we're going to have a junior version, call it, of debt deleveraging in the corporate sector. And so I think that's something that we want to consider, that if you are bullish on corporate credit, be bullish for the right reason. The right reason is not because the Fed saved the day for the economy. I think it's too late for that. I think it's because of corporate decisions aimed at cutting back on their spending plans this year and making sure that they meet their debt service payments against that backdrop.
Dave, I really wish we could go on. I'd love to ask you a whole bunch of more questions, but in the interest of time, we're going to need to leave it there. Your folks at Glusk & Scheff were kind enough to send us your current slide deck of 48 slides, which go well beyond what we had time to talk about today. I strongly recommend, listeners, that you download that. The download link is in your Research Roundup email, or if you're not yet registered, just go to our homepage and look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads next to Dave's picture. I want to particularly, though, Dave, call people's attention to slide 47 in that deck, because although you said a few minutes ago that nothing in finance is forever, I think the thing that comes closest to forever is the Breakfast with Dave newsletter, which has persisted and followed you through three or four different career changes. It's probably, I don't know if this is an exaggeration or not, but it might just be the most widely read daily paid subscription newsletter that exists anywhere. We've got an opportunity here, which Patrick, my producer, was able to negotiate with Marcel Alls there at Glusk & Scheff, which you don't give everybody. This is a free month of Breakfast with Dave, which is extremely well-regarded in the industry. So I want to thank Marcel publicly for giving our listeners that free trial offer. Folks, you're going to want to take advantage of this one. Dave, give us a quick overview of what people can expect to find in the daily newsletter.
Well, the daily newsletter is really just an amalgam of my big picture and small picture thoughts. So It gives you a lot of analysis on the data and on the markets globally. So it's really small picture in the sense that I go through with what's happened in the past 24 hours to update you on any changes and which ones are significant and which ones you should ignore. And I also pepper that with some of my big picture themes and how they're evolving over time.
And you can get a free one-month trial subscription by emailing Marcel Alls, that's M-A-U-L-L-S, at gluskinchef.com. That full email address is on page 47 of the slide deck, which is linked in your Research Roundup email. Dave, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with David. You know, it would have been a shocker to me if he didn't come on and stay bearish. That's the one thing that's true to my heart, is knowing that David's on the bear camp, and something that, you know, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about throughout this chart book that we're going to be talking about in the post game. But what did you take away from the interview?
Well, Patrick, I always enjoy having Dave on the program. He's a fantastic guest. His comments about modern monetary theory really kind of resonated with me, because it feels like all the smart people are seeing the same thing, which is, hey, some of us disagree with modern monetary theory and don't believe in it philosophically, but we're all smart enough to see that this is the trend. It is picking up steam. It's getting a lot of political support, and it seems to be the new trend that is gaining momentum. So I think regardless of whether you agree or disagree with modern monetary theory, you got to learn about what it is and what it prescribes and what we're likely to see in terms of policy as people who are proponents of MMT gain more political standing in society. And that seems to be the trend. But Patrick, I want to move on, because you've put together another one of your famous big picture trading chart books. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not registered, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says looking for the downloads next to David Rosenberg's picture. Patrick, let's go ahead and dive in here on page 2 of the chart book. You're showing a couple of scenarios of what the S&P might do next.
Right. Well, so on chart 2 is actually a throwback from a month ago on February 14th on Valentine's Day, when we shared a chart book last time. And what we did was I drew on two paths on the weekly S&P chart as to what the price action would look like if we were developing far more of a bullish scenario where this market could, you know, break out to new highs, versus that of when it will get really toppy and start to show signs of rolling over. And what I wanted to just do is update on page 3 where we're at since then. So we've had, you know, about 4 weeks of price action. And what is clear is that it seems to be following far more of a bullish path than the bearish one that I drew on. That, I mean, those are just squiggles I put onto the chart. But it's a very big question, isn't it, to ask whether or not this is going to break out in a big way. One of the big stories, of course, there's those individuals such as I would say I'm far more in the David Rosenberg camp, where I'm skeptical of its sustainability. But there's no shortage of people out there that are now of the opinion that we're about to break to all-time new highs. And one of the interesting things I wanted to, what I've heard at least out there, was a lot of people comparing this to 1998. And they were saying, you know, in 1998, late business cycle, everything seemed to be incredibly expensive. You know, there was this 20% market correction in the markets. And then it breaks out, and in 99, it rips higher. And so I wanted to just spend a little bit of time with you, Eric, just kind of going through what it really were the markets doing in 98. And is this really a scenario that is emerging right now? Because, you know, even though I want to be bearish, bearish. We have to kind of contemplate, well, what would it look like if it was going to be bullish? And then that way we can redraw our narratives if that becomes the unfolding reality. So on page five, I have a chart here. And on page five, it shows that, you know, through 1997 into 1998, the effective Fed funds rate was pretty flat. And then in the middle of 98, they started cutting because we had that big market decline in late 98 that saw about a 22% decline in the markets. Now, I wasn't an active trader back then. I was just getting out of school and getting onto the trading desk. So I can't say I was trading the market back then. But I would imagine that there was a lot of people that said that that was it, right?
Oh, I was one of them, Patrick. And, you know, I remember 1998, that summer, extremely well because it's the year that I sold my software company. I'd come into a bunch of money and I wanted to use it to short tech stocks because I knew the valuation that, frankly, I got for my company was pretty high. And I thought that valuations in general were crazy. I was right about that. They were crazy, but they got more crazy for the next couple of years. And that is, I think, an excellent analogy to the risk that we have here. I remain absolutely convinced that the market should go down from here because it's crazy for it to go higher. It was crazy to think it was going to go higher in 1998, but that's exactly what happened. And as you've drawn here on page five, a 69% advance in 18 months. I would have gotten killed if I was shorting tech stocks then. And I'm obviously glad that I didn't do it. And, you know, as we come up on 2877, which would be the same if we go back to page three for just a second, if you look going back at the beginning of 2018, just before the VIX complex melted down, 2877 was where that left shoulder would be. We moved a little bit higher than that where we put the top in. And now maybe we're about to put in a right shoulder. It's only 10 points higher as we're speaking now to get to 2877. Maybe that's your sell point to sell a right shoulder and it's going to be all downhill from there. But, you know, I would have thought that in 98. And as you're showing here, I think it's extremely relevant. Look at what happened in 98. It was crazy to think that prices could go higher from an already elevated, ridiculous bubble high. But that's exactly what they did. And, you know, anything's possible.
So, you know, I want to get to that in a few minutes when we talk about it, because there's, I think this is a great opportunity to be putting on a short the way that I wanted to express it. We'll talk about it in a second, but really I think the key observation that I want to point out, well, the Fed was somewhat accommodative in 98, right? Like they basically were cutting rates into what was all the emerging market risks that were developing in there. And then the market goes shooting higher. But what I'm showing on page 6, 7, and 8 were some of what the other big macro markets were doing. I mean, what was fascinating to me is that through 1999 into 2000, the dollar index was ripping higher. I mean, we were seeing the dollar index, I think in late 98, we were down around the 94 handle. And then the dollar index shot up to almost 120 on the upside. But what was fascinating was that while the dollar was making that move, crude oil, which put in its low in 98, near $10 a barrel, went to $37 a barrel by middle of 2000. I mean, hundreds of percent return advance in crude oil markets. I mean, you would think that inflation fears must have been quite prevalent during that period. And what was interesting about that is the 10-year yield skyrocketed because of that. We had the 10-year yield in 98 trading around 4.25, and it shoots up to almost 7% in just 1 year through 1999. And so you had bonds selling off, yields rocketing, crude oil prices rocketing, dollar rocketing, and the stock market rocketing. Like, what a crazy time. But is that kind of a scenario what people are anticipating here? Like, I don't know whether I see this being 90. I mean, the only thing I see similar in my mind to 98 is the fact that we're late cycle, and that because we're late cycle, that there could still be one more blow off. But how, like, do you see the kind of comparison in anything beyond just the fact that it was late business cycle?
Well, the biggest thing that's resonating in my mind as we're talking about this, Patrick, is the mistake that I've made before where I've said, okay, look, so the Fed's accommodative, but the reason they're accommodative is because they're panicking and the picture is really bad, not good. And surely any day now, the market's going to see through this and recognize that bad is bad. And, you know, even in the face of accommodation from the Fed, the market will realize the Fed's accommodating because they're panicking and that's the reason for it and it's not going to continue. Well, that proved totally wrong. The Fed conjures money out of thin air and it has to go somewhere. And where it goes is into asset prices. Now, the place where I think it will likely be different this time is I think we could be setting up for a situation where as the economy weakens, maybe the market starts to weaken substantially. Everybody is expecting that there's going to be another round of QE that looks like the last three rounds. And what happens is due to political pressure, instead, we get helicopter money. We get QE, but it's completely different. It is in the form of universal basic income and various other social spending initiatives, which are funded by deficit spending. Modern monetary theory folks have advocated this kind of approach. They're gaining political momentum. So I think potentially what happens is asset prices don't get saved by the next round of QE because it's a very different flavor of QE than we had the last three times around. I think that's where the big surprise risk for markets could exist. But, you know, as much as I want to say, oh, but the market's going to see that, you know, the reason the Fed is so dovish this week is because they're panicking that the economy is worse than they think, that's not going to make the market go down. The Fed is being more accommodative. It helps the market go up as much as it doesn't make sense to me. The last 10 years have taught me that's just how it works, even though I think it's crazy.
So, Eric, what I wanted to just do on pages 9, 10, and 11, what I have here is I just ask a simple question, how to trade the current market setup. I find myself in the bear camp. And to be honest, the fact that there are more and more people starting to jump onto the bull bandwagon is somewhat welcoming because one thing I've always learned personally from the markets is that rarely does the market ever reverse and start to go down until everybody has thrown in the towel on being bearish. And so the fact that everyone wanted to be bearish a month or two ago actually made me more nervous about it. So the fact that there's people contemplating the upside here more and more is actually a good thing from a sentiment perspective in my mind. But I'm in this camp that I still think that this market can roll over here. But the big question, of course, is how do you put on a trade where you can manage an entry into this? And so on the S&P 500, we just surpassed that 28 and a quarter I'm showing on chart 10 on the S&P, which is now open the window for, you were suggesting the 2877 mark, but also those highs at 2950 are going to be very important as the S&P goes higher. And I'm interested to test out the idea that those levels are where there's going to be an opportunity to short. And one of the things that I find incredibly appealing right now is the fact that volatility is back down. And I just have the generic VIX index chart on page 11. But really what we're seeing is now volatility, implied volatility, is back down to the ranges it was in for most of 2018, right? In that kind of 11 to 13, 14, 15 range. And what I like about that in these low volatile periods is that putting on call and put option trades, we're getting the trades on much lower vol premiums. And this allows us to have less vega risk and a lower cost and allows there to be more asymmetry in the trade. And so I can't think of a better time to start looking at options as a way to playing the market here at such a pivotal crossroad.
Well, Patrick, I'm all ears because as I told you on this program a couple weeks ago, I said, I don't know about the options approach, Patrick. I think I'd rather just use an outright short. Well, I took that approach, shorting 28.12, which was a key fib level, and I was stopped out of that short at a maximum loss, and I do still have my put spreads. So there's definitely a strong argument here for it's hard to tell exactly where the top comes, but there are some obvious levels like 28.77 and 29.50 where that seems like it would be a really logical turning point. It's a good place to start adding some short exposure. The question is, what's the best way to do that? As you say, and we've been very clear with our listeners in past shows, when the VIX was shooting up, we said, look, as much as we like options, it's not the time to be buying options if the VIX is this high. VIX is back down to the level where options are cheap. So what's the best way to play it? Let's say we get to 28.77. That would be the point where I would be tempted to put on another short in my futures account. But frankly, I lost enough money on the last one. I'm not too excited about that. How would we play it with options?
Right. So what's interesting is I'm actually approaching it with the same strategy that I used in 2018. Our longstanding listeners know that I was fortunate enough to actually catch both of the major market tops in February and later in October using this strategy. And what I'm finding is that in this environment, this is actually a great time to go back to that strategy. So what I used back then and what I'm using again right now is a strategy using a straddle, but it's not a traditional option straddle, just buying a call and a put, but I'm calendaring it. And there's a reason why I'm calendaring the two options is because the way I look at the market right here is that the prevailing trend is up and the path of least resistance is up. And on balance of probabilities, the market is going to continue to edge higher. But if the market was to turn, the selling downside is where the real big money is and the opportunity to profit immensely. And so in my mind, this is where calendaring the options in the straddle make the most sense, because what I want is a longer dated put option, which has a smaller gamma that is positioned for a bigger downside move and is hedged in the straddle with a shorter dated call option, which has that higher gamma and lower cost. And so if the market continues to rise, barring that it's not doing it so slowly that the theta is burning you out, then often your call will be making you more money on the upside than you're losing on the put on the downside. And this allows you multiple times to reposition to try to find out where the top is. And so this is a strategy I've used in the past, and I'm using it again, and I'm looking forward to putting together a great little webinar for our listeners to actually learn how to do the strategy.
Well, Patrick, I don't think that could possibly be more timely. I'm going to tune in myself because I want to look at this just for the reasons I described. I think that 28.77 is a good place to short. I think 29.50 is a good place to short. If it happens, I don't know where it's going to happen. It wasn't 28.12, and I want to learn more about this strategy because I know that you and your members totally nailed it twice in 2018. So the webinar is next Wednesday, March 27th, noon, New York time. And is it free, Patrick, or is this one of those free deals where I have to give you my credit card to get it for free?
No, it's going to be completely free. On top of that, we're going to be throwing in a 2-week free trial to Big Picture Trading so that you get to actually see us implementing the trade real time and how we're managing it. And so we're going to take you through what the trade is, how it works, and then you get it in part of the membership to see us actually implementing it. And no credit card required. Free means free.
Fantastic. Well, I'm definitely going to tune in, and I encourage our listeners to do so as well. It is completely free for Macro Voices listeners. You'll find all the information at the end of the chart book, or you can just email contact@bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to need to leave it there for this episode, though, folks. We do need your help promoting Macro Voices, because the more registered users we have, the better able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. So please tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices. Retweet us when we announce the show. That offers us a lot of help. And most importantly, register your free account if you've not done so already. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just links to all of the best content content that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what they can expect in this week's Research Roundup.
In this week's Research Roundup, you're going to get the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to download the PDF chart book for David Rosenberg's interview, as well as the information to try the Breakfast with Dave. There's also the link to the chart book that Eric and I discussed in the post game, including the links to join me for that live webinar on how I caught the last two market tops. As well, there's an interesting article talking about the battle of the quants as Kolanovic counters Charlie McElligott with six reasons why it's time to buy. So lots of really interesting things for you to read this weekend. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners who write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com. or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.